on the AM and FM 107 Radio Network, broadcasting from AM and FM stations around the country. Welcome to the Small Business Administration award-winning School for Startups Radio, where we talk all things small business and entrepreneurship. Now, here is your host, the guy that believes anyone can be a successful entrepreneur, because entrepreneurship is not about creativity, risk, or passion, Jim Beach.
Hello, everyone. We've got a cram-packed great show for you today. We have two great guests. First up, we have Stephen Mays to talk about the power of three leadership model. It is fascinating, and we have a great conversation, and I'm really excited to share him with you. After that, we're welcoming back to the show Douglas Squirrel and his insanely profitable models. He is one of our favorite guests, and that's why he is back today. So it is a great show, and I appreciate, as always, you being with us. Also, I wanted to share with you that the book, The Real Environmentalist, made Forbes. There's a write-up in Forbes about the book. It is linked at the site, realenvironmentalist.com. Go check that out. All right, big show, start in a second. We are back, and again, thank you so much for being with us. I'm very excited to welcome to the show now Steve Mays. He is a longtime U.S. Navy submariner and atomic energy specialist. Let's put it that way. And he has his Dolphin Award, or maybe lapel award, to prove it. He is author of a book called The Power of Three: Lessons in Leadership, and also has a consulting business in the same name. Steve, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thank you for having me.
And thank you for your service.
Well, it was my honor, my privilege.
What are the little dolphin things called?
Well, they're called dolphins. It's the equivalent for submariners as aviators have wings.
Okay.
So when you become a licensed, when you become a qualified pilot, you get wings. And when you become a qualified submariner, you get dolphins.
And how long does that take? What do you have to do to achieve that?
Well, it takes about a year of intense work and study and testing and drilling and things like that once you arrive at your ship. There's two kinds of dolphins. There are silver dolphins, which is what the enlisted qualified people wear, and there are gold dolphins, which is what the officers wear. So there is a little bit of difference in the qualification requirements, because the officers are the ones who are going to be driving the ship and being in charge of the reactor and those kinds of things, and the enlisted dolphin wearers are the ones who are in charge of operating all the equipment on the ship. So it's also a significant thing about having to know the ship well enough so that any kind of an emergency, the officers or the enlisted people can go to the place of the emergency and handle it quickly and effectively, so that we all get to come back home from port rather than spending the rest of our lives or rest of our days on eternal patrol, as it's called in the service. If you mess it up badly, you go on eternal patrol.
Yeah, I understand that. Trump just went to UK and made a nuclear deal with the British for smaller reactors, and they're making a big deal out of it. Doesn't the submarine you have a small nuclear reactor that could be powering a city or something like that? Why are we arguing over these huge, huge power plants that cost billions and billions of dollars? Why don't we just make a whole bunch of small ones like they go in the submarines? Wouldn't that just be a lot safer and easier?
Well, there are a number of reasons. The power output of a submarine reactor is about 1/1,000th of what a commercial nuclear power plant does. And the most of the nuclear power plants in the country right now that provide electricity are in the 3,000 megawatt thermal range. The new reactors are called small modular reactors. They're designed to be safer and more efficient and be capable of being kind of mass manufactured, as opposed to being a single plant build. Yep. So there's economies of scale there, and they're smaller, but you can when you have the smaller ones, you can build up enough of them to cover whatever your need is. And if you don't need as many, you don't have to have as many. So it's kind of like the difference between a semi truck for hauling big loads and a fleet of small vans for hauling smaller loads.
Right.
In smaller and in more remote localities. So, and also the submarines have much more highly enriched fuel. So it's there are issues about not wanting to have fuel that could be easily transformed into a bomb.
Sure.
And the enrichment on submarines is higher, which allows them to be more energy dense, which allows them to be smaller to produce the amount of power needed.
All right. I learned a lot there. That makes a lot of sense. And I like the idea of the small ones that are almost, that are identical. That just makes a lot of sense to me.
Well, it does make some sense because it dramatically reduces manufacturing costs. And because of the design of things now are much more advanced in terms of safety and security, you can put several of them together in a single building to operate, as opposed to having to build two or three very large ones over a large period and have them power many cities. You could have small modular reactors that would provide small cities or even rural areas, as long as you had transmission line to get to them.
Right.
So it's a matter of not having to build a semi truck when all you really need is something to take your family to the ballpark.
All right. Tell us about your work recently and your concern about leadership.
Well, I've always been concerned about leadership because I've always had a career in leadership in mind from the beginning. That's why I went to the U.S. Naval Academy in the first place and why I chose the submarine force in the second place. And then when I completed my naval service, I found work in national laboratories. I found work in consulting for safety. And then I found work at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission as a safety expert and as a manager. And then I went back into the consulting business again. And I found leadership to be really, really important to how well people were able to work and achieve. But I found that the same things that were occurring in the Navy that had some really great leaders and some relatively poor leaders were the same factors that were having national laboratories and consulting companies and utility companies and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and federal civil service having the same issues. And so I began to wonder, well, why is this so hard? And that was one question. And when that other question was why did I have to go through all the hard problems to learn the lessons? Why couldn't somebody have told me these things before I got to the problems? So that led me to sit down one time and as a friend of mine told me, I should write a book about leadership and put down my thoughts about it. So that's what I did in the Power of Three Lessons in Leadership. And what I found was, first and foremost, we don't teach leadership to people very well or very in a timely manner. For example, if you're really a good machinist or a mechanic, you get really good developing your talent. And then somewhere down the line, somebody says, well, we've got 5 or 6 or 7 machines working here. We need somebody to lead them. Okay, you're the best mechanic. Now you're the leader. Well, that person doesn't know hardly anything about leadership because they've been working on mechanics. And the same is true in other fields as well. So the question is, why are we spending all our time on people's talents all the way up from the time they're in high school, college, first job, second job, until they get to some level of effectiveness in their talent wise, and then we decide we're going to make them leaders? Why don't we teach them how to be leaders before they get to be designated leaders? So it's like nobody would have a doctor come in and do surgery on them who hadn't been to med school. So why do we expect leaders to be effective if they've never been to leadership school?
Leadership classes in the Army, Navy, all
some
the service branches?
Some. They're getting better at it than they used to be, but it's very limited. And the problem, if you go and look at the literature on leadership in any place, you can look at it, you can Google it. Everybody is focused on one of two things. everybody's focused on a thing called leadership styles. Everybody has talks about there's the autocratic leader, there's the democratic leader, there's the servant leader, there's the empathetic leader, there's the charismatic leader, there's the participatory leader. There's all these different styles of leadership. And then the other thing everybody's always interested in is personal traits. Personal traits that supposedly great leaders have, so that if you know what those personal traits are, you can embody those and you will be a great leader too. But that just doesn't work. And here's why. I'm going to mention six universally well-known leaders that everybody believes was a great leader. And I'm going to ask you a question.
Ooh, a game. I love it.
So here's your first question. Did Patton have the same leadership style and personality as Gandhi?
No, I'd say they're almost the exact opposite.
Well, did Churchill have the same personality and style, personality or leadership style and personality as Nelson Mandela?
Maybe, because they were both known for their inspiration and
they had some features in common, but their personality
and closer than the first pair.
That's true, because they were in the same involvement in politics and stuff. So there's some similarities there. Now, did Douglas MacArthur have the same leadership style and personality as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.?
No, MacArthur was kind of a showboat type guy, I think. And
yeah, correct. The point is, obviously, they were very, very different people in terms of style and personality. So if they're very, very different people in terms of leadership style and personal traits, how can leadership style and personal traits be the thing that makes them great leaders? Because you could be great leaders with or without those personalities and styles. So it's an inadequate determinant of whether or not you're going to be a good leader. Let me give you another example. One of the big things that's popular in leadership training these days is empathy. Leaders have to have empathy. And I'm not against anybody having empathy. But if empathy was so important, then I'll tell you what I would do. I would call up the owner of the New York Knicks, and I would guarantee them that they were going to win the NBA championship next year, because I was going to make sure that their new head coach was the most empathetic person that he could possibly hire. So let me introduce you to the new head coach of the New York Knicks, Mother Teresa.
Yep.
Now, obviously, Mother Teresa is not going to win them the NBA championship last year. She doesn't know anything about basketball. But somebody who knows tons about basketball and has no empathy and can't communicate with people probably isn't going to get them to win either. So the question becomes, why are people having so many struggles with leadership? And I figured it out in these ways to my mind about why I had struggles in leadership. And that's because nobody ever put down a comprehensive concept of what leadership really is. It's all kind of fancy words and jargon and slogan. It's all talk about the icing and not the cake. It's talking about the sizzle and not the steak. So I set out to try to put something together, being a mathematician and an engineer as a educational experience that would satisfy my concept of, well, if you're going to make a rule about something in math, you have to be able to prove it. And to prove it, you have to set out your parameters, and you have to show the model, and you have to show that when you have these parameters in this model, you get this result. And so I said, why can't we apply that to leadership? And so that's what I ended up doing, was putting together a model of leadership in my book. And it's called The Power of Three, because it has three very distinct levels. The first level is a foundation. You can't build anything without a foundation. I don't care whether it's an outhouse, a skyscraper, a railroad, a nuclear power plant. You have to have a foundation. So what's the foundation for leadership? You won't be able to find the foundation of leadership in very many books or very many things that people talk about. You'll hear about things that are important to leadership, but you won't have it here determined that this is what you need, that without this, you will fail. And I think I've captured that. So the foundation for leadership consists of three things: honesty, courage, and talent. But we spend all of our time working on talent. So let me give you an example of why talent's not nearly as important as honesty and courage. Did Richard Nixon resign the presidency because he lacked talent?
No, he was just the most insecure human on Earth, I think.
Among other things, yes. Did Bill Clinton lose his law license and pay a big fine because he lied on a deposition in court and lose the House and the Senate to the Republicans for the first time in 50 years because he lacked talent?
Oh, he just lied about it.
Yeah. All right. So, and I picked on a Republican and a Democrat, and to be more fair, I'm going to pick on a military person next. The same day that I threw my cap up in the air at the Navy Marine Corps Memorial Stadium in Annapolis in 1974, there was another gentleman who threw his cap in the air up at the stadium in West Point, New York. This man went on to become a very well-known and well-respected leader in the Army. He became a general. He was considered one of the greatest strategic and tactical generals of all time. And then he got out and was put in the position of the director of the CIA. So he had the same kind of experience to a limited extent that I did, except he went further in his military career. And he was the head of the CIA. So he was the head of keeping the nation's secrets. Except he had a secret. He was having an affair with his biographer. And when that became public, he couldn't be the head of the CIA anymore, so he had to resign. So my question is, did David Petraeus, the guy who was the one who developed and brought the counterinsurgent strategy to Iraq, to Iran, and to Iraq to end that war, was he having to resign from the CIA because he lacked talent?
I bet he had a different kind of talent.
Yeah, his problem wasn't a lack of talent that caused him to lose to lose his job.
Yep.
So the question is that what were the other factors? And the two factors I had mentioned previously were honesty and courage. So let's talk about what those mean for a second. Honesty isn't about whether you tell lies or not, or whether you that kind of thing. It's a little more subtle than that. I borrowed a concept from Scott Peck, who wrote the book The Road Less Traveled. Honesty is seeing the world and your place in it the way that it is. Not the way you want it to be, not the way you think it should be, not the way that it could be if those idiots in charge would just get out of the way and let you have your way. See it the way that it is. Now, let me give you a really humorous example of that. Are you married?
Yes.
Okay, then you'll recognize this. You'll recognize this problem. You're getting ready to go out to a dinner party. You got your. Does this dress make my butt look big?
Yep.
Okay, now that's the universal problem that represents the problems of communication between men and women. All right, so most people, I ask them this, what's the honest answer? And if the answer is, well, yes, her rear is getting bigger. So you tell her yes, and then you get to spend the night out with the dog in the doghouse. And she's not speaking to you, and she's mad. Or you can say, I'm not going to tell her the truth, because that's, quote unquote, the honest answer. I'm going to tell her that it doesn't look like she's putting on any weight. And because I don't want to hurt her feelings, I want her to feel good about it being in her dress and we can go to the party. Now, you've done that. You're not in trouble with her right now. But now, every time she asks you a question in the future, she goes, I know he lied to me. Is he lying to me again? Just because neither one of those is the honest answer. Because if a leader, if you're thinking honestly, she's not really asking you about whether or not she's gaining weight. Nobody on the planet knows better what her weight situation is than her. She knows whether the dress is tighter than it was the last time she wore it. She knows whether she's putting on weight. That wasn't her question. See the universe and the world and your place in it the way it is. She's asking you a different question. And what she's really asking you is, honey, I'm starting to put on some weight and I'm afraid I won't be attracted to you anymore. Is that true? Now, here's the honest answer. Honey, I love you in that dress. I think you look gorgeous. I love you in everything you've ever had on since I first met you, and I always will. See the difference between being honest and being truthful?
Yes, good example.
Okay, the next one is courage. And since I always use three in everything I have, courage is defined as three things. overcoming fear, to take actions that benefit somebody else without regard to the consequences to yourself. All three have to be present for you to demonstrate courage. Now, the trick in the foundation is that you need to have honesty so you'll understand what you're doing and you won't have as much fear to overcome, so that you can then do something for somebody else and ignore whatever the consequences are to yourself. And most people will think about that and they'll think, yeah. Like the Secret Service agent who jumps in front of the president and takes the bullet. Or the army guy who sees a grenade get thrown into his foxhole with his buddies and he jumps on top of it and takes the blast and saves his buddies. Well, that's a pretty severe case of that, but that's fear and overcoming it. But it's a lot more common than you think. But we don't look for it, we don't encourage it, and we don't reward it. I'll give you a story about my daughter. My daughter is the most empathic person I know. When she was she's 6 years old, she's in first grade, we'd pack her lunch to go to school, and they would go to the schoolroom, they'd put their lunches in a little wagon, and when it came time for lunchtime, the teacher would take the wagon, drag it over to the lunchroom, and sit the students down. And she would sit them apart, so they weren't next to each other. And she'd break out their lunch boxes, and she'd tell them, sit here, don't talk, eat your lunch. Three rules, three things they told her to do. And so I was confused as to why every time my daughter came home from school, she never ate a bit of her lunch. And so my wife and I asked her, I said, why is that? She says, well, I don't have enough time. So since my wife also happened to work at that school, she went over to her teacher and said, how come Jessica doesn't have enough time to eat her lunch? Because she's got plenty of time. Well, she says she doesn't. See, can you kind of let us know what's going on? Well, they told her. They told her and they told me, and my heart just broke right in the spot. Because there was a kid in her class whose parents were very wealthy. And when the wife, who was normally working, got pregnant and had the son, she quit working, and so this son, the first face he saw every day was mom. The face he saw all day long was mom. And the face he saw before he closed his eyes to go to bed at night was mom. Now he's in first grade. Mom comes over and drops him off at school. He's a little nervous about that, but there's some other kids around. There's an adult figure around, so he kind of muddles through all that. Then lunchtime comes. He gets in a room. Everybody's separated. The teacher's gone. And he's told, sit here, eat your lunch, and don't talk. And right in front of him is the lunchbox that mom made. He watched mom make his lunch. And now he just has overwhelming separation anxiety, and he just starts to cry. So my daughter sees this young man crying. She gets up from her spot, walks over to where he is, and starts talking to him. And eventually gets him to stop crying, and they're talking, and gets him to start eating. He's eating his lunch. And then pretty soon, the teacher starts walking down the hallway, and she can see the teacher coming from afar out the window. So she runs back over to her seat and sits down. And the teacher comes in and says, pack up your lunches, put them back in the wagon, and we're going back to class. So that's what the teacher told us happened. And so when Jessica gets home, I said, Jessica, how come you didn't eat your lunch? With this big, and she knows by my tone of voice that something's up. She's got these big brown doe eyes, you know, and she looks at me with that kind of sheepish grin and look on her face, and she said, I didn't have enough time, Daddy. I said, Jessica, I think you had plenty of time, didn't you? And, you know, looking like, uh-oh, I've been found. And she looks up, and she doesn't say anything. She just kind of sniffles a little bit, and she goes, uh-huh. And I said, you didn't eat your lunch because you were busy trying to take care of your friend, weren't you? Mm-hmm. And I said, Jessica, I am so proud of you for wanting to help your friend. But for God's sakes, girl, you can eat your lunch while you do it.
Yeah.
But I realized at that point in time, I had just been given a lesson in what courage really is by a six-year-old. She overcame the fear of disobeying the teacher. She went to do something for somebody else. And it caused her to not eat her lunch. She was showing me the definition of courage. And quite frankly, that's why I wrote it up that way in my book. And I even put that story in the book. Because people do that all the time. When you see somebody who is disregards fear, helps somebody else out, and doesn't care whether they get in trouble or not, that's courage. And when we see people doing courage, we ought to note it. We ought to recognize it. We ought to encourage it. But we don't. So people who aren't grounded in honesty and don't have a good baseline in courage have their talents become worthless.
Steve, we need to wrap it up there. We've run out of time. And we only got through the foundation, but that's good because you've whetted our appetite for the rest of the book. So how do we get a copy, find out more, follow you online?
Well, I have a website that you can go to that has most of what's in the book, as well as some other stories that I've written after the book was published. And it's called powerofthreeleadership.com. That's all one word, POWER, the number three, POWEROF, the number three, leadership.com. And so there's a picture of the diagram and a discussion of each of the elements of the thing, and then a list of stories that apply to each one of those areas that where you can go to. Like the one that's on the front page right now is, remember several years ago there was a young man who was playing football for the University of Maryland, and he died during training camp. Well, I have an essay on there on where did leadership fail. And when you go and look at it, once you have this picture in mind, you can see all the places where leadership at the University of Maryland failed, and this kid ended up dead.
Wow. See, thanks for being with us, and we'd love to have you back.
Okay. Anytime you want, I'm available and more than happy to talk about leadership. My mom says I was vaccinated with a phonograph needle, so I do talk a lot.
And we will be right back.
Well, that's a wonderful question, actually, Jim.
Oh my gosh, I love the opportunity to do this. Thank you, Jim.
Wow, that's a great one. You know, that is a phenomenal question.
That's a great question, and I don't have a great answer.
That's a great question.
Oh, that is such a loaded question, and that's actually a really good question.
School for Startups Radio.
We are back, and again, thank you so very much for being with us today. I'm excited to welcome back to the show Douglas Squirrel. He is calling in from the UK, where he lives in a house that was built in 1450. Imagine that, a house built in 1450. He has an amazing tech career and is very influential in helping others. He writes the Insanely Profitable Tech Newsletter and is very active with hundreds of organizations in the UK, US, Australia, and around the other parts of the world, and coaching a wide variety of leaders to improve their conversations, their business goals, and to have less conflict. Douglas?
No. Wait, Jim, I got to correct you.
What?
Jim, we want more conflict, but we want it to be productive.
Ah, that's right. Creative, productive conflict. All right, tell us about
that. You got
that.
It. So I was just coaching someone literally minutes ago on this topic. I was telling him, look, if you have trouble getting people to do, for example, a weekly demo to show what they've been working on, and they say, oh, I don't have anything. I don't have anything to do. I'm not ready for that. Then the thing to do is to have them do it more often. How about every day? And then that'll produce more conflict. They'll be less happy, but they'll get an awful lot more feedback, five times as much. And therefore, you'll get much better results out of them if you actually counterintuitively don't do what they're asking, what they're complaining about, but increase the frequency.
What if they just quit?
Well, maybe that's a good idea. If they're really not working on anything valuable and they can't show you any results, why are you paying them?
Yeah, it sounds like that employee's ripe to get asked to leave.
Yeah, well, and this is a way of increasing the visibility, making sure, as I often say, there's no place to hide. And, you know, there's an awful lot of hiding, especially on tech teams, but also in marketing and sales and other places. People are doing something that seems valuable, it seems useful, they look busy, but it's not actually useful. And if you increase the accountability, for example, through this kind of weekly demo process, or even daily, then you get a greater opportunity to see whether they're actually producing value.
Shouldn't you have some measure already of what they've been doing every day, every week?
Sure, but lots of people don't. And so a good way to start is by having some kind of weekly or daily process. If you already have one, super, but then there already isn't a place to hide, so you don't have as much of a problem.
I have all of my employees, especially the ones who work overseas, produce a daily list of what they've done.
Amazing. Boy, I wish all my clients did that. Or actually, if they all did, then they might not need me. So I'm glad lots of people don't, so I can help them to do that. But Jim, your process sounds great. My only question is, how do you know that they're producing value when they do that? So if they say, you know, I posted a bunch on this social media platform to promote your podcast, how do you check on that?
Check on? You mean, how do I find out whether they really did it or not?
And whether it's valuable, because they might have put up a lot of posts. I don't know if you have people do this, but whatever it is they might be doing, they might do a lot of activity, but it might not be valuable. How do you know?
You know, with social media, I don't know at all. I don't believe in it at all. I'm one of the skeptics.
Okay, good. Well, then I picked a silly example, but what might you ask them to do?
Well, you know, I do ask them to post things, but I do it because we're told we have to do it, you know?
Uh-huh.
I don't believe in it. And I think it's
so. Why don't you stop and see whether it affects your listenership and everything else?
Well, then it would be bad. I mean, if it affects the listenership, then we've proven we should have done it. I mean,
but you could do it for a short time. All I'm doing is just illustrating the kind of coaching I do, Jim. You don't have to pay any attention to what I'm advising you. You're obviously very successful. But I have people approaching me all the time who say, I don't know what my team's doing. They do report on what they're doing, and I can't tell if it's valuable. And I often tell them, have them stop, because that's a good way to find out quickly whether it's actually useful or not.
Yes, my doctor had me stop one of the medicines I was on to see if it was actually
there helpful. You go.
And yeah, see, I got worse. So
okay, but then you knew the medicine was valuable, right? So you went right back on it.
Exactly.
Super.
What do we
see, Dr. Squirrel, here at your service?
What are we seeing with coding now? Is it going to be killed by AI?
Absolutely not. So I had somebody talking to me last week, and I had to really put the brakes on and say, "Hang on, you're headed the wrong direction." Their philosophy was any developer can learn any piece of code in minutes, and they can suddenly be perfect at writing that code. Nothing could be further from the truth. You know, I call that the kind of Matrix fallacy. Did you ever see the Matrix movie?
You know, I think I might have walked out on it.
Okay, right. Well, it might not be to your taste. But one of the things in the Matrix movie was that you could sort of magically make a phone call and say, I'd like to be a helicopter pilot, and they would magically sort of insert that in your brain. We haven't got that, and AI does not give you that. So what you need is very senior people to oversee the AI and who can learn things relatively quickly, not instantly. And you need different disciplines. You need different skills, things called front end and back end and so on. Don't worry about what they are, but you need those different skills and those abilities that match up with your technology so that somebody can catch the AI making mistakes, which it does all the time. You can think of it like a very eager, very knowledgeable person who's just graduated from computer science program. And they're really eager beaver, but man, they don't know what they don't know. And you've got to supervise people like that who are humans, and you also have to do it with computers.
Well, can't you just wait for the results? That's that page is pretty. They built me a nice website. That's what I
want. Yeah, well, the problem is, what happens when you then advertise it and a million people show up and it falls over? Because the AI didn't realize that although it looked pretty, it wouldn't scale.
Okay.
And that's where you need that senior expertise. And although it's amazing to do this kind of vibe coding stuff, I teach workshops in it. If your listeners want to talk to me about it, I'd be happy to show them how they can produce those pretty prototypes and really make a lot of progress without engineers. But before you go to production, before you put it on your real live website, before you start actually selling stuff with it, please, for the love of God, get a real engineer to look at it for exactly the kind of problems I was just describing, scaling and security and all kinds of other stuff that the AI is going to whiz right by, making a pretty page.
Right. So, you know how when they came out with printers and the computers started having printers, and everyone was like, oh, we're not going to need this. We're not going to, you know, print. And
yep.
And printing quadrupled, you know.
Indeed, because it was easy. You got it.
Well, also, it's so, you know, you make three changes, it's nice to have a new printed version, you know.
Don't indeed.
You
want
a new printed version each time?
Mm-hmm. And you didn't have to type it all up on a typewriter. I remember typing on actual physical typewriters, and that was a pain, but you could just push print and it would come out again. Yeah, I agree.
And so we're printing and using 10 times more paper, right?
You
is
got
that
it.
The
yep.
way it's going to be with AI? It's going to need more yes. people to supervise it?
Well, I don't know that we'll need more people, but we're going to need people with a lot more experience. And this is one of the biggest challenges in the industry, is how on earth do we train the juniors? Because we're going to need these people who are super duper experienced, who know where all the bodies are buried and all the problems are and what to look out for. And how do you make those? We used to make those by having journeymen and apprentices who would go and do the grunt work. Now the AI is going to do a lot of that. So it's not clear to me that you need more, but you need more experience.
Okay, and how do they get that experience?
Well, the industry doesn't really know. What seems to be emerging, and this is kind of a saving grace, we're just getting lucky. It's not because anybody planned. It turns out that a lot of the juniors equipped with AI learn very fast because they have a sparring partner. You know, it's like if you're a boxer and you go in the ring and you kind of fight with someone, even if it's not a very good someone, you get better at punching. And so the juniors are some of them, the ones who are learning fast, who are really motivated. Those folks are actually learning very quickly to be more senior. So they're accelerating their pace of improvement. So there's kind of a race going on here. How much are we going to be improving the AI so we have more of it and we need more supervision? And how quickly can those folks at the junior level increase their skills? So anything you can do to help those juniors improve their skills by hiring them, putting them next to seniors, helping them improve, that would be really good for them.
All right. When we talk about all of this, are you worried about the catastrophe situations, the doomsday predictions where everything just goes to hell? The AI takes over and kills us all.
Not at all. Have you heard about bacon ice cream?
No.
So McDonald's tried to put AI in charge of its drive-thru, and it started serving people bacon ice cream. And the poor folks back who were actually making the food were quite confused, as were the customers. Taco Bell has just done this, and the problem they're now having is people are ordering like 18,000 cups of water. And the AI is putting it through and just agreeing, sure, no problem. Hertz is having a lot of trouble because they've put in AI to check for dings and marks and things, and it's finding reflections of sunlight and saying, ah, $350 to repair this problem, which is a reflection. So AI is not very skilled at an awful lot of things they would have to be good at to kill us all. So don't waste your time worrying about that. Worry about things like how we're going to make use of it and how we're going to avoid some of the problems like bacon ice cream and charging for reflections.
I saw an interview with Sam Altman, and if we had to pick the person who really, really in real life is a Bond, James Bond villain, it would be Sam Altman.
Okay, I may quote you on that. That's a good one. Ignore some of the hype there. That these guys are all pushing their products. They've put billions and billions into huge data centers to make them work. This is a bubble, and it will burst, but it'll burst in a positive way, like many others. You know, we had folks like that who were pushing the internet as the solution to every online shopping problem in the world, and we'd all be buying everything online. Well, we kind of do now, but in 2001, that wasn't true, and there was a bust, and one is coming. But it will result in overall advancement and lots of use of AI where it's appropriate, maybe not in drive-thrus.
Right. Well, that seems like it would be an ideal situation.
No, it's really challenging because although the AI can do a lot of the basics and listen to normal conversation, if you show up and order 18,000 waters, it's not ready to handle that. And AI is real good at handling things that it expects to see, things that were in its training data that were are common circumstances. It's really, really bad at situations that are unexpected and abnormal, especially where someone's trying to exploit it or use it in a bad way. So you want to be careful with that. I wouldn't mind it being in a drive-through where there's a human who's supervising and making sure that the orders actually make sense. But letting it go by itself, that breaks the first rule of AI.
So when we have some sort of balance return, is it only going to be a stock market crash, or are there going to be other 100 AI businesses that go out of business overnight?
I'd be surprised if a lot go out of business overnight, but I imagine there are lots of folks who have overhyped in the Sam Altman way, and who have rolled it out in places where it has no business being, and those folks will get sorted out. You might remember Pets.com, and I forget what the other one was. There were a bunch of them back in the around the 2000 period when everybody was going online. They were selling all kinds of crazy stuff. Same thing is happening with AI. There's lots of use cases that make no sense, and there are some where it's brilliant. You know, it's amazing at doing research and finding out information and summarizing it for you. So people are using it in finance to trade. People are using it in manufacturing to manage the manuals and the diagnostics for their machines on the factory floor and finding out what error 17 means, and that's stopping your production line. There's amazing uses of it where it makes sense, but there are lots of places where people are using it where it makes absolutely no sense, and it's just going to make people miserable.
Another thing that Sam Altman said is that very, very, very few people are paying for it, and that's a problem. They don't have paying customers.
I don't know where he's getting off with that. He's the one who's charging $20 a month, and loads of people are paying, including me, because when you use it appropriately, it's a great search tool. You know, it's 50% replaced Google for me, because I get much better results with a lot of context and a lot of information. Sometimes it lies, and I have to go and catch that. But that's okay, because when it's not lying, it gives me some really useful information. And I pay him, and I'm quite happy to do that. And he's got quite a very successful little business going there. Now, it's a small piece of his overall business. Maybe what he means is not enough people are paying him enough. And that's because I think he's tried to spread too thin. He's trying to do way too many different use cases. And if he concentrated on the highest value ones, he'd probably be better off. But lots of people are paying for access to these tools. I think one problem that certainly we're going to have is people don't know what value they're getting. Go ahead, sorry.
He's saying that not enough people are paying, that it's a problem, that they don't have the cash flow that they need.
Yeah, well, that's because he's increased his cost so high. He thought everybody in the world would buy this, and only a billion people did. So I'm not going to cry a lot for Mr. Bonville and Altman, who spent too much of his VC money on maybe making the bubble bigger than it actually is. But certainly for your listeners, they should be trying these tools and finding out about them and paying Mr. Altman and his friends to find out about them, and then figure out ways to use them that are most effective, that actually make sense, where you have humans in the loop and you're providing value through research. That's what these tools are really good at.
Let's talk about your book a little bit, The Agile Conversations.
Oh, yeah.
How do we have better conversations?
Well, the first thing is to be curious, and just far too few people start conversations being curious. Now, we've had a wonderful conversation here, and you're asking me all kinds of tough questions, which I'm having a blast listening to. But I bet if your listeners sat down and wrote down the words they said in their last difficult conversation, almost none of the sentences would end with a question mark. And that's a big problem. So if you want to have better conversations, for example, with your tech team, like we were talking about before, you might say, hey, this thing on your daily list of tasks, I don't know if that's valuable or not. Do you know? Could you tell me? How could we find out if that's valuable? Is that adding listeners to our podcast? Is that increasing our reach? And if you were having questions like that, asking open-ended, genuine questions, you would find out an awful lot more from your tech team, including whether they're able to answer those questions. And that's a really valuable thing to know.
Well, this is advice for life, too,
yes.
Isn't it?
It certainly is. And lots of people tell me that they've used the techniques in their marriages or in their friendships. And I say, great, just don't tell me about your toilet training. I'm not allowed to talk about that. But certainly it applies in many, many different aspects of life, and most particularly, it's useful in any situation where you might naturally want to advocate, where you might want to say, hey, this is the right thing to do. I want you to do this. This is the outcome. I'm right. That's exactly when you should ask more questions, because you're probably wrong in some important way. And finding out why really helps you, especially in areas like technology, where you might not be as much of an expert as the person you're talking to.
All right. So what is the beauty of the question mark? Why is it so useful? You know, for example, Douglas, in improv, the beautiful word is and.
Exactly. And how I teach people to do yes and.
Yeah. So talk to us about that and the beauty of the question mark.
Oh, well, the beauty of the question mark is that if you ask a genuine question, now there's a difference, but if you ask a genuine question, you often are surprised by the answer, and that means you're learning something. Now, learning is not fun. People think, oh, I love to learn. It's great. No, learning means you found out you were wrong before, and now you're finding out that there's something else that's right. And that's usually pretty painful, but it's also extremely valuable. There's a way to make sure you don't learn anything, though, which is to not ask genuine questions. And I'll give you an example of a not genuine question. Jim, were you outside the bank with your in your car, revving the engine, waiting for your friends to come out of the bank after they robbed it? Now, that's a leading question that I might ask you if I was an attorney trying to convict you. And it doesn't get to any kind of, it's not a real meaningful question, right? Because there's only one answer. And if you say, no, I wasn't, you sound unconvincing. And if you say, yes, I was, we're going to put you in jail. And there's lots of questions like that that people ask that are very much leading questions, and they don't lead to surprising answers. Whereas a question like, how would we know if this action you were taking yesterday was valuable? How could we prove it or disprove it? Might lead to all kinds of answers like, well, I didn't do that yesterday. Or there's no way to know. I'm sure it's not valuable. Or we could find out, but it would cost us this much. Those are all possibly surprising answers that could really improve your business. And that's the kind of question you should be asking.
And how does this change culture?
Well, it leads to people having much more psychological safety, which is a little bit surprising. You know, psychological safety just means you're willing to say, hey, I screwed up. There's a problem here. There's something dangerous. I might have not done something right. And you really want people to do that because, say, if someone posts in an ineffective way, you want them to learn from that. You want to learn from that. And then they can say, stop doing X and start doing Y, and that will increase our listenership. So you want people to have that psychological safety. If you ask them open-ended, supportive questions, like the ones I've just been illustrating, then what they say is, it's going to be safe for me to say, actually, I don't know if this is valuable. Maybe it's not. I've been doubting it, and I've been wondering whether I should waste my time on this. But Jim seems to want me to do it. Now he's asking me this open question. Now I feel safer about saying, actually, Jim, this is a dumb idea. We should stop. And you really want to hear that from your team.
I don't know. I don't know that entrepreneurs want to hear that. When I was last running a business with a lot of people, the overwhelming feeling I had was the model works. Let's not mess with it. Quit bringing me ideas.
And that's dangerous. I hope that you tried to undermine that wherever you could, because the problem with models, especially in new and up and coming businesses, is that they shift all the time. Suddenly somebody introduces a new AI tool. Somebody adds a new process. Something changes. And if you're not on top of it, if you're not learning from it, you're in a world of trouble.
Unless the model truly is just working.
And if it is, let's prove it. Let's find out. But let's continue to test it. Let's experiment. Let's doubt whether or not what we think we know is accurate. Because if we just believe we know it, why are we bothering? We can just turn the crank and make tons of money. That would be super. If you, Jim, know how to do that, please fill me in, because I would love to. I'm in a state of much more doubt, where I'm productively wondering, what could I do better? What am I doing that's ineffective? How could I improve it? And if I'm always asking that question, I'm always getting better.
How do you measure that?
How do I measure getting better? I want to do it with business results. So in my own business, it's number of consulting clients. In your business, it might be number of people who listen to the podcast, number of adverts
we
you sell.
We count stations.
Say again?
We count stations. I measure myself by how many stations I am on.
Oh, fantastic. Excellent. So you have a nice metric. Did something that you did increase ultimately the number of stations? And you might need a leading indicator. I call it sometimes an imperfect indicator that says, well, I've got more listeners, therefore I can go to more stations and get myself on more platforms. That would be great if you can measure that and then iterate on it and improve all the time. If you think you've got the magic method that gets you the number of stations you want and you never change it, and someone else invents a better way, they might come along and eat your lunch. And I sure wouldn't want that to happen to you because I'm having so much fun talking to you.
Yes, it's just not as competitive, I don't think.
How do you mean?
The radio space is not that competitive.
There's plenty of inventory, plenty of space, so you're not competing with others?
Yes, I think so. There's so much demand for new content.
Well, great. That's a super problem to have, because then what you have is a competition to be interesting, because there's lots of supply, and everybody can watch YouTube all day, right? What's whatever, a billion minutes a minute or whatever that people upload. So there's lots and lots of competition for eyeballs and for ears. And what I'd be wondering is, how can we get more of those people listening to you, telling all their friends, and therefore helping you with your business? And I'd sure love for you to get not only on more stations, but get more listeners on those stations.
Yes, that would be nice. That would make sponsors happy.
I bet it would. So then that's a metric that you could use. How are we measured? How do you even know how many people are listening? I'm sure that's a challenging puzzle, but one you can solve. And then you could ask, these are more open, genuine questions, how can we increase those number of listeners? How can we know that they came from this social media post or from this advert or something else, whatever it is you might be doing?
That is why one of the hard things is measuring the number of listeners. As an industry, we're not good at that.
I know, but there must be ways for you to measure responsiveness to ads or other proxy metrics, and I call those, as I was saying before, imperfect indicators. They don't give you the right answer, but they give you a directionally correct answer, so you can say, well, you know, when we ran this online poll and we told everybody about it on the radio program, it used to be that 10 people would answer, and now 100 people answer. I don't know whether that means we have 1 million listeners or 500, but I do know it means we have a lot more.
Yes. Very well done. Douglas, we are out of time, I'm afraid. I feel like I could ask you questions all day.
It's always so much fun, Jim.
Is programming getting better?
Yes. AI is making it a whole lot better, although more challenging. You have to be smarter.
Okay, because I'm hearing the exact same number of I give up. You know, I hired a programming company in India and I'm giving up. I'm going to eat the 30,000 and start over. I'm hearing more of that than ever before.
Look, any one of your listeners who says that, or anyone who says that to you, Jim, please tell them to phone me. My telephone number is on douglasquirrel.com. Okay. And I love when people just phone me. It's this old thing, you know, where you can phone people.
Yes,
you don't have to send an email first and a Calendly invitation and so on. Please tell them to phone me, because there's a lot they can do. Whether that's fire that particular team or not, I don't know. But certainly there's a lot they can do to get much better results. And it's all the things we've been talking about here today.
All right. How do we get on your newsletters? Find out more. DouglasSquirrel.com. Yeah, so what else?
Newsletter is squirrelsquadron.com. That's my community. And me and my phone number and so on is douglasquirrel.com.
Fantastic. Thanks for being with us again. Great conversation as always. And we'd love to have you back.
Absolutely. Lovely. Fantastic. Thanks, Jim.
We are out of time, but back tomorrow. Be safe. Take care. Go make $1 million. Bye now.